right?
You know, talking about the way they did about Hezbollah in Syria and whatever and all that stuff. And what's the result?
Well, there we are. I think that.
You know, your own defense minister does a coup d'état.
Yeah.
And, you know, now you got the Europeans and the American envoys coming and telling you, well, you know, just accept reality. Let's move on.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, the more we progress in history, the longer we are around and we see the things as they are happening, the more we realize that from the very, very beginning, Imam had gotten it right all the way.
All the way, he was. I mean, this is the miracle, isn't it? I mean, this is the genius of it all, that just shows the, you know, some kind of divine quality that of the Imam that he.
Well, if you're connected, you're connected,
yeah.
and it's not anything mysterious.
No,
you know, you have to be careful of the way you said it. People might think there's some sort of we're trying to. There's nothing mysterious about it. This is the normal way that Allah works.
This is the normal way that Allah works.
You're
quite right, sir.
I stand corrected. Yes.
Mm.
Yes. You have to be careful the way you talk about these things.
Yeah.
Because this is exactly the things they use against us.
Yes.
When you read the Quran, this is a normal cause and effect.
Allah normal says, cause and effect,
trust me, I will take care of you.
Mm. Quite.
This is not a miracle. It's a normal way that Allah does things.
Yes.
He says, I'm your wali. What does that mean?
Mm.
Not Tawhut, not, you know, others are your wali.
Mm.
When you trust in Allah the way Imam did, you will be successful.
You will be successful, absolutely.
More than that, we even have the ayat in the Quran, which all the Mufassirin, Sunni and Shia, say that refer to Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Mm.
And they talk about being the ones that are successful and being the ones that are the party of God and
being
the ones that will be, you know, the ones that are in this world, successful in this world and in the next.
That's right.
So why don't you follow the Quran? Forget about the Hadith right now. We're not talking about Hadith.
No, we're talking about Quran, yes.
I'm sorry, because you are Mr. Hadith, so I apologize.
No, the Hadith is always secondary. It's a secondary source. The primary source is the Quran.
Imam is following Imam when he talked about what he did in terms of how we should live our Islam and how we should be active politically.
Yes.
He was talking Quran.
He was talking Quran. Very nice. That's very beautiful. That's very
so
beautiful.
So why don't you follow Quran?
Why don't you follow
when you're
following? Yes, because you said the Quran was kafi, wasn't it? It said that the Quran was enough. And the Imam proved that the Quran is enough if you follow it.
Well, what I'm trying to say is that when you follow Imam Khomeini, you're following the Quran.
You're following the Quran, absolutely.
It's not about Sunni Shia.
No, it's not.
Why was Imam successful? Why was the Islamic Republic successful?
Yes.
Why is the Islamic Republic successful?
Mm.
Why do we have great leaders like Rahba, the supreme leader that we have?
Yes.
And he's a great leader. I mean, look at him. I mean, I'm talking about just, you know, as a Muslim, looking at somebody as a religious scholar, as a political leader.
Yes.
Who is guiding us.
Yes.
Isn't it great? You know, thank God we have somebody like him.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, and this is not about, you know, hero worship. This is about thanking God for, you know, putting the appropriate leaders for us.
Exactly.
Before there was Imam.
Yes.
And, you know, and the reason these people are good leaders is because they follow Islam. They follow the Quran. They follow the school of Ahlul Bayt, the Islam that is taught by Ahlul Bayt. And God says that if you do this, you will be successful.
You'll get good governance.
You won't be oppressed. You won't be, you know, 1 minute the president, the next minute in jail.
In jail, yes. I mean, this is what we can say about the beautiful scene that we saw just very recently with Dr. Rouhani's inauguration as president, that how smoothly things were transferred.
And again,
it came with a kiss from the supreme leader. You don't get kissed often as a president,
again,
do you?
Again, let's make it real for a second.
Yeah.
In the speech at that time, what was the main point that the supreme leader talked about?
Sure.
He said, it is a great blessing that the transfer of government in our country is done peacefully.
It's done peacefully, absolutely. Absolutely.
He said, this is one of the greatest blessings.
This is a great thing, absolutely.
And then he said, look at Egypt.
Look at all the
other countries.
Yes, he did. He did compare it. Of course he compared it.
So look at us. Mm. We followed Imam. Imam was following the Quran and the school of Ahlul Bayt, which is Faghalain.
Yes.
Quran and Ahlul Bayt, which is back goes back to what the Prophet said.
Yes.
The Prophet, peace be upon him, said, I will leave you two weighty matters. I will leave with you two weighty things.
Sure.
The Quran and my Ahlul Bayt.
Yes.
And if you follow
No, that's a very good question. It's a very good question to our audience.
Why are you going after people and things that have no value to you?
No.
Will lead you to Zulamat.
Yes,
no,
and will lead you astray. Yeah.
They will lead you to darkness.
Darkness.
Look at what happened to Morsi. Make it a lesson for yourself.
Mm.
Look at these poor guys in Turkey, in Ankara.
Absolutely.
They don't know what to do now. There's
the same problem in Tunisia. I mean, this is widespread, you know. I mean, Libya is in absolute chaos. I mean, what can you say?
You know, so this is the thing.
Mm.
When Imam came, there were, you know, the humanity, and especially the Muslims, were thirsting and were completely in need of guidance.
Yes.
The guidance, that's the real guidance. If you're going to have, to go back to our example that we used in the previous program.
Yes.
If you have the computer and then you put the wrong
software in it,
it's not going to work.
Yeah, it doesn't work. It'll never
work. You might even have it working for a while, but then there's so many bugs in it and there's so many problems with it that eventually it crashes.
It crashes. Very good.
Good. Are we now talking, you know?
I think so. It's the same language. I
you get it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it's a very good paradigm. It's a very good model to express
you
the
know,
idea.
It might work for a while. It's like, you know, it's okay. Should we go further on this? It's like Apple versus Windows. Okay.
Yeah, chalk and cheese.
You know, you're gonna have certain operating systems. They might work for a while, but they've got so many bugs and problems in them. They're gonna crash after a while.
Well, they're gonna crash. Exactly.
Some of them don't even work to begin with. Mm. Others, they work for a while and they crash.
Yes.
What you want is you want the one that doesn't have the bugs in it.
That's right. It's got the antivirus in it, you know. It's.
It doesn't even need the antivirus.
Virus.
Beyond all this stuff.
Very good point. Yes, it doesn't even need the antivirus. You're absolutely right.
Right.
Yeah.
So, when you're a Muslim, and you have a person like Imam coming and living at approximately the same time you did, right? You have no excuse on the Day of Judgment then.
No.
You can't say to Allah, "I didn't know." He said, "Why? You didn't know? Well, there was Imam. He was on every channel on TV."
That's a very good point, yeah.
Right?
I mean, I watched him on News at 10, you know, on ITN in the UK, so I don't have much of an excuse either,
right.
You know.
You know, 50,000 websites, you know, hundreds of books, you know.
True.
What's your excuse on the Day of Judgment? I didn't know. Of course you knew.
Of course you knew.
You knew, not only knew because of the Quran and the Rivayat that were, you know, available to you, but more than that, it's you had somebody who, you know, is an Islamic scholar.
Yes.
Who is a practicing, you know, Muslim, who is a political leader telling you.
Yes.
So alhamdulillah, those of us who were, you know, fortunate enough to have been living in his time, you know, alhamdulillah, because he really taught us real Islam.
Sure.
Because who knows where we would be without him?
Oh my goodness. I think the tyranny of the Shah would still be continuing to this day.
You know what's even worse than that? We would be caricatures of Muslims.
You would be. That's true.
Yeah.
Absolutely
you too,
true.
By the way.
I know. I wouldn't be here for a start. I mean, where would Scottish independence be? You know, I don't think anything would have happened.
Well, I'm trying to simply say that even if you were Muslim, which is inshallah we would all be,
yeah,
but
inshallah.
we would be very, you know, it would be a caricature. It would be a very good.
Yeah,
of,
I mean, I don't know. Maybe I would have been
a weak version of it. You know, we have this thing. I mean, Imam comes and tells us, look, if you want to do Islam, it's all of it. It's holistic.
It's holistic.
It's a package. It's a full program.
Full program, yep.
It's, you know, it's your night prayers and it's, you know, your political activity during the day. This is also what Supreme Leader talked about. We talked about this in the previous program.
That's right.
You know, he would pray at night and beg for mercy from Allah and you know, have that kind of,
faith and trust in
God,
Allah,
which is what you want.
Yes.
That, you know, you have nothing and you have to get everything from Allah.
Get everything from Allah, yes, absolutely.
And during the day, you would, you know, come out like a, you know, lion and be a champion of the Muslims and be the one that.
And the champion of the oppressed, yes, absolutely.
Of all the oppressed.
Of all the oppressed, absolutely.
So this is what Islam is. It's not just, you know, praying and fasting. It's more than that. It's good. You pray, you fast. That's the basis of it.
That's the basis of it, yes.
Right. So again, nobody should misunderstand what we're saying. We're not saying you shouldn't.
No, we're not saying that. No, this is the basis of it.
We're saying that's the minimum.
That's the minimum. Yeah.
You
sure.
know?
That's the minimum. Absolutely.
And I'm not claiming that I'm any better than anyone or that I do more than all that.
No.
Maybe, you know, I'm doing the minimum as well. But that's the minimum. Don't think that that's the maximum. That's not the maximum. That's just the beginning.
That's just the beginning, yes.
The maximum, or close to the maximum, is what you see with a person like Imam.
But Imam
the real
Khomeini.
Maximum is what you see
Rahmatullah
with the Prophet,
absolutely.
Him,
may God bless
and
him.
And with the Imam, alayhi salam.
Sure.
Right?
Because so it's all about
more.
It's all about us trying to become to achieve some kind of perfection and salvation in this world. And Imam Khomeini, may God bless him, gave us a living example of what that could be in this century,
right.
And beyond.
You're right, and it's not just this kind of parochial. I think about it, and it really upsets me to think about that they would turn Islam into this kind of very unimportant thing of like, oh, just the way you clean yourself and the way you pray and like that's it. Allah, all the 125,000 prophets because of that,
My God.
All the wars, all the struggles, all the struggles of the Prophet, peace be upon him, all the struggles of the Imam, Shahadat, Karbala, Ashura, because of that.
No, it's ridiculous.
Is that it? I mean, it's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous.
It's a ridiculous notion that this would be Islam. It's a ridiculous notion that Islam wouldn't be political. It's a ridiculous notion.
Absolutely.
It's not even worth discussing.
No. It's a very serious point. This is something that really our listeners
problem.
Must
for 34 take years we're trying to explain to the Muslims themselves that no, really, Islam is political. It's not even worth discussing. It's not even, of course it's political.
It should be something second nature to you.
Of course it's political.
Yeah.
Of course it has to do with society. Of course it has to do with helping the poor. Of course it has to do with helping the oppressed.
Yeah. And establishing an Islamic civilization, a system.
Exactly.
A system by which we live
and
die.
Islamic, and establishing Islamic governments is just the first step for that.
Yes.
The next step is, and the ultimate goal is Islamic civilization.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay, and we're not the ones that are imperialist and wanting to impose it on all of humanity, because that's what's going to happen when we have Zuhur.
Yes.
In terms of, that's not our job. Our job is not to impose things on anyone.
No.
Okay?
No.
I don't even know what's going to happen after Zuhur, but that's not even my concern right now.
No, no.
Zuhur is going to happen, and whatever's going to happen is going to happen.
That's that. But at this moment in time, we're concentrating, as you say, on getting the foundations in place.
At this moment in time, our goal is to build a strong, powerful, enlightened, conscious, ethical, moral Islamic civilization. All
sure.
of us.
Sure.
All of us.
Every
part of
Sunni,
of
Shia, everybody's involved in this.
Those living in the Muslim majority.
Yeah, this is a big
Africa,
project.
Asia, wherever.
Yeah.
Those living in non-Muslim countries who, consider their primary existential reality and identity as being Muslim and not other things.
Sure.
Or those other things as being, secondary to that. That's your job right now. That's our job right now.
Absolutely.
We have to build Islamic civilization, and it has to be a beautiful one, and it can't be the Takfiri, organ-eating one.
No,
and
it can't be. No. I don't fancy eating anybody else's liver right now. Yeah.
And it can't be the Turkish, Jordanian, slaves and servants of America and Israel. Mm. Okay?
Yeah.
You get it?
Yes,
you see where
absolutely.
I'm going with this?
I'm going along with
it. It can't be the Ali Saud, authoritarian dictatorship, passing it from one brother to the next,
No. I mean, these are tyrannies. These are tyrannies.
That can't be Islamic.
No, I mean, these are tyrannies. They've got to be got rid of. This has got to go in the past. It's got to go into the dustbin of history.
What it is that beautiful Islam as Imam taught us.
Yes.
As the supreme leader has been teaching us for these years of how to stay on the Sirat-e Mustaqim.
Yes. On the path of righteousness.
Extreme on the left, not become extreme on the right.
No.
Right?
Absolutely.
Focusing on knowledge, focusing on education,
wisdom.
Focusing on wisdom, focusing on, building societies.
Absolutely.
Focusing on all these things that we see that this is what, beauty is something that is fitra. Again, it goes back to fitra.
Yes.
Human beings recognize beauty immediately. Mm. You don't have to explain it to
no,
them.
No, you don't. No. This is something that's part of their fitra.
Mm. When you look at a society like Iran, which went from being a, feudalistic society, majority illiterate, 50 years ago, to a society where the youth are all, capable and educated and, on the forefront of all these different things, who are conscious, who understand the world. I mean, isn't this beautiful?
Absolutely.
Isn't this what you want for your children?
Exactly. Dr. Madhi Tarabi, I'm afraid once again, you know, time is against us, but, you know, we've run out of time on the program. But thank you very much indeed for that enlightening contribution to, you know, the life and times of Imam Khomeini. And, of course, we'll be speaking much more in the future about this great man, I think, you know, for all time to come. I mean, this was a personality beyond time. How can I put it? You know, I don't have the words even to express that as far as Imam Khomeini is concerned. May God bless his soul. But thanks once again, Dr. Madhi Tarabi, for being on the program.
My pleasure.
Thank you. And it just leaves me to say for our listeners, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I hope you benefited from the program. May God's mercy and his blessings be upon you all. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
U.S. Cruiser Vincennes. Bandar Abbas Airport, 9:30 a.m., July 3rd, 1988. 274 passengers of Flight 655 from Bandar Abbas to Dubai were waiting to board the plane. A child asked her mother how long it would take to fly between Bandar Abbas and Dubai. Her mother said, less than an hour. The flight was scheduled to depart at 10 a.m., but the travelers were informed that the Airbus A300 flight had been delayed. 274 passengers and 16 crew members, 290 people in total. Persian Gulf, near the Strait of Hormuz, 7:45 a.m., July 3rd, 1988. One of the helicopters of the U.S. cruiser, Vincennes, reports that Iranian boats are hovering around a German cargo vessel. The Vincennes cruiser moves quickly towards the German cargo vessel without being asked.
We remain alert and we'll stay alert. But at the same time, I don't want to ever give the impression that we're leaning forward on our toes to get a major conflagration started here. That's not the case at all.
The war that the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein started on the last day of the summer of 1980 against Iraq entered its eighth year. Throughout these years, the Iranians wanted to put an end to the war through winning the land war. From the second year of the war onwards, they had been always far superior to the Iraqi army on the battlefield after being surprised by the beginning of the war. Operation Karbala 5 took place in early 1987. At the end of the bloody Operation Karbala 5, Iran had a superior position and was able to penetrate through the defensive line of Shalamcheh. The progress of Iranian forces towards Basra resulted in significant outcomes. The United States sent the aircraft carrier USS John F. Kennedy to the Persian Gulf to prevent the defeat of Iraq and the fall of Basra. Die Welt and Spiegel wrote that the United States was ready to fight Iran with 6 battalions in 600 warplanes in the event of the collapse of Basra. The Soviet Union also expressed its concern over the continuation of the war and stressed that the war had to be eventually ended with negotiated settlements. Perhaps the Iranians will never forget the statement of the Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberger. Weinberger said, "Iranian people should be exterminated by cutting off Iran's oil production so that the war will be over." And years later, Secretary General of the United Nations, Javier Perez de Cuellar, wrote in his memoirs, "Following the adoption of Resolution 598 in July 1987, the United States definitely believed in order to end the war, one, the Iraqis had to firmly stand against Iran's victory. Two, the war had to be more painful for Iranians than any other time. Three, the flow of weapons to Iran had to be reduced through another resolution within the Security Council. And four, there had to be a great deal of international pressure on this country." In 1987, the Persian Gulf was the scene of the confrontation between Iran and the United States of America, in which many heartbreaking and painful incidents took place. In the spring of 1988, Iran was going through a tough situation. After the fall of Al-Faw, the U.S. government announced that it would support not only Kuwaiti and Saudi ships, but also other countries' ships and, in general, shipping in the Persian Gulf. They officially announced that all Iranian leaders had to know that the continuation of attacks in the Persian Gulf would not be tolerated.
On the morning of July the 3rd, we were coming back through the Straits of Hormuz on the way to pick up another ship for an Ernest Will escort mission. And there was some radio communications indicating sounds of explosions or such coming from Montgomery and Vincennes.
German merchant Uligari, this is U.S. Navy warship. We are standing by channel 1-6. Over.
Okay, 1-6. Do you read me?
Merchant Uligari, this is U.S. Navy warship. We read you loud and clear. Over.
Okay, thank you.
On the morning of July 3rd, Captain McKenna, chief of the U.S. Naval Operations Center, was startled to discover that Vincennes' cruiser had moved away about 64 kilometers from where it was supposed to be. Then he promptly ordered Vincennes and Montgomery back south to their original location.
It was our concern, however, that Vincennes was acting in an overly aggressive fashion, or so it seemed, and that they were actually pursuing these boats rather than being pursued by them. The IRGC were sort of a ragamuffin band, if you will. I mean, they were not very well coordinated, and certainly it wouldn't be too difficult to scare them, I don't think, into doing something that was foolhardy. If they saw a lot of military machinery bearing down on them, they could easily become frightened. It was our business out there to defend shipping against those guys, but not to provoke them. We don't know how close to the boats the helicopter actually went. There was, without getting too technical, a fixed distance that they were supposed to maintain. If, in fact, they were harassing the boats, which may have been the case, how would the boats communicate with them? Well, they would generally fire warning shots. We'd seen that happen with news helicopters there in the past. If the news helicopters or the media helicopters got too close to Iranian small boats, bog hammers, if you will, or whatever, warning shots would be fired and had been fired in the past.
An American helicopter pilot informed William Rogers, the commanding officer of Vincennes, that Iranian gunboats had fired at his helicopter. Rogers ignored the return order, move towards Iranian territorial waters and convince Captain McKenna to authorize him to shoot Iranian boats. At 9:49, the Vincents opened fire on Iranian boats.
Shots, or were they actually attacked? The helicopter wasn't hit, after all, and the helicopter could escape the area at great speed, and in fact it did. So therefore, what was Vincennes up to in going to general quarters, accelerating to maximum speed, and heading off to those boats, which at the time presented no threat to anyone?
I did not send the Vincennes to support the Montgomery. I authorized the Vincennes to send their helo. I was the only one that was in authority to send them anywhere, and my understanding was that they had asked permission to cover the area with a helicopter and that they were also told to remain on station. Management at the time specified, and they were very clear-cut, that you will return fire with fire, and so they asked permission to take the units under fire. I gave permission and reported the same to Commander of Mideast Force.
In Bandar Abbas Airport, 274 passengers of Flight 655 from Bandar Abbas to Dubai boarded the plane so that pilot Mohsen Rezaian and his colleagues would fly them to Dubai. The Airbus, a passenger plane, took off at 10:16 after a short delay and was supposed to land at Dubai Airport in 28 minutes.
During that engagement with the small boats, the aircraft lifts off from Bandar Abbas and then proceeds on course, essentially, slightly off schedule, as has been noted. I think they were 20 minutes or so behind schedule, climbing on a fixed course, using the proper IFF, and so forth and so on.
The Vincennes sailed into Iran's territorial waters in pursuit of Iranian boats by 10:22. And violated maritime law.
Officer Deck, presently hold the ship, crossing the Iranian declared war zone line.
We did take the 12-mile limit seriously. Everybody was very concerned about it. Incurring into the 12-mile limit was verboten, and people were supposed to hold short of this 12-mile limit by several miles to prevent that from happening.
The aircraft was proceeding on a course that would take it directly over the Vincennes position. Recall again that Vincennes was in the middle of a gun battle with these small boats. Now, perhaps a battle of its own making, but firing nonetheless.
When I briefed in with the commander of the Mideast Force, I know that a very serious concern of his, as a matter of fact, he said, Dick, the one thing that I am concerned about is shooting down a civilian aircraft.
The Iranian passenger plane was ascending when the Vincennes crew saw it on the radar screen. The Airbus A300 passenger aircraft did not look like the F-14 Tomcat. A passenger plane is much larger compared to a fighter plane, and it also flies slower. However, the Vincennes crew believed that they had mistaken this giant plane for a tiny F-14 Tomcat.
I was told that it was an F-14. I watched it. I took a look at its altitude and its speed. It was climbing. It was slow. It was in the middle of our missile envelope. The F-14, to my knowledge, had no significant anti-surface warfare capability, so I designated this thing in my own mind as a non-threat. Captain Rogers, on the other hand, involved with his gun battle at that time, announces that he is intent on taking that aircraft out at 20 miles. It's climbing. It's slow. It doesn't respond. It's in the middle of our missile envelope, basically. It's vulnerable. Why would this aircraft present a threat that did not meet any of the threat parameters that were? If Captain Rogers believed it was a military aircraft, and if he believed, as we think he did, that it was part of a coordinated effort at that point, a coordinated attack, then in his mind, he could see this as a threat.
Tense. It did make the situation much more complicated.
Both ships had attempted to communicate with the aircraft, and we were unsuccessful. We got no response back.
We could hear the challenges go out on military air distress and the civilian version of the air distress channels. So we were aware that they were warning an aircraft, an approaching aircraft.
Typically, if you could not communicate with an Iranian airplane, military aircraft, you illuminated them with your fire control radar, you let them know that you were there, and they would generally depart the area. When we illuminated it with our fire control radar, it didn't react.
And did not have the capability to talk directly to the commanding officer of Vincennes, simply because he was engaged on a very personal basis in a fight. And I knew they were about ready to pull a trigger on a missile that could kill my pilots. And I wanted to make absolutely certain that they didn't become the victim.
Air hostile at 004, true, 21 miles.
The aircraft crosses the 20-mile mark. And he doesn't shoot it down. At that point, I breathed a sigh of relief, thinking that, okay, he has now seen that it is a non-threat.
Size is right here.
Size.
Okay.
What I'm told transpired during that period of time afterwards is that they weren't capable of getting the shot off in an orderly fashion. So although the intent was to shoot it down at 20 miles, they sort of bungled the operation.
William Rogers, the commanding officer of Vincennes, requested a permission from the command center to open fire on the Iranian fighter jet. The soldiers and crew members of the Vincennes cruiser became increasingly nervous when they heard about a possible attack by the Iranian fighter jet, and fear fell upon them all. The Iranian passenger plane was ascending, though a fighter jet does not need to get high to attack an aircraft, and it is capable of attacking the target so quickly. The passenger plane sent the codes that indicated it was not a fighter aircraft, and they could identify the aircraft based on the communications between the pilot and the watchtower. However, the commanding officer of Vincennes said they received no codes from the passenger plane, so that he decided to shoot down the plane. A few minutes later, 18th minute into the flight, the passenger plane disappeared from the Vincennes radar screen, and the crew of the American cruiser started embracing each other. They did not know that their happiness would soon fade away, and that was the bitterest day of their lives, the bitterness of which would always remain in their minds. A few meters away, there were 108 women and children among the 290 people who were killed. An eyewitness says, while collecting the bodies of the passengers, we saw a woman who had hugged her child. She was hugging her so tight, the baby was stuck in her arms. We would not separate them. A child who had thought it would take less than half an hour to get off the plane at Dubai Airport.
We had individuals who were up in places where they could see wreckage fall and they could see the airplane coming down. It wasn't until sometime later that they described the wreckage in terms that led us to believe that it was not a military aircraft. It was too much, too large.
An Iranian Airbus is presumed crashed. Please look for survivors or aircraft wreckage.
I killed over the entire force. They spent a considerable amount of time. There was nothing there. And it's also fairly ironic that the Vincennes is the one that came upon the wreckage when it started to become apparent that this was an airliner that was involved. It was just a sickening feeling for the entire rest of the day. I can't ever remember being so dismayed, so depressed, so feeling for all of the people that were involved. It wasn't a very happy day in the Gulf for us, that's for sure. The Sides was dispatched to go close to Dubai to see if they could find wreckage. And
firstly, the Americans announced that they had shot down an Iranian 14 Tomcat. And once the truth came out, they claimed that the Iranian plane had deviated from the flight path and had ignored all 7 radio warnings issued from the Vincents. Later on, it became clear that the Iranian plane was ascending along a legal flight path. 4 years after the incident, the New York Times wrote, "It was a Vincent's cruiser that illegally crossed into Iranian territorial waters. However, American officials have covered it up."
After receiving further data and evaluating information available from the Persian Gulf, we believe that the cruiser USS Vincennes, while actively engaged with threatening Iranian surface units and protecting itself from what was concluded to be a hostile aircraft, shot down an Iranian airliner over the Straits of Hormuz. The U.S. government deeply regrets this incident. Given the threatening flight profile and the decreasing range, the aircraft was declared hostile. Vincennes fired 2 standard surface-to-air missiles, at least one of which hit at an approximate range of 6 miles. An examination of the events on 3 July leads quickly to the conclusion that Iran must share the responsibility for tragedy and the investigation so found. By any measure, it was unconscionable to ignore the repeated warnings of the United States and permit an airliner to take off from a joint military-civilian airfield and fly directly into the midst of the ongoing surface action in the Strait of Hormuz, which the Iranians themselves had initiated.
The United Nations Security Council, July 16, 1988. An emergency meeting was held at the request of the Iranian representative to the United Nations to review the incident of the passenger plane being shot down. Iran's foreign minister and U.S. representative George W. Bush spoke at the meeting. Bush told Mr. Velayati, "This would not have happened if you had stopped fighting the war." He continued, "Minister, I am telling you that you need to choose between ending the war and confronting us." The war had become painfully torturous for the Iranians, and Resolution 598 was accepted 2 days after the Security Council meeting and the Airbus incident. On July 20th, 2 days after the adoption of the United Nations Security Council resolution on the crash of a passenger aircraft, a resolution was issued. A resolution that only expressed regret about the occurrence of that incident and included a few general statements in its other paragraphs. It also contains some recommendations concerning the prevention of future incidents and supporting research by the International Civil Aviation Organization. Iran simultaneously requested an emergency meeting from the Security Council and asked the International Civil Aviation Organization, ICAO, to initiate the investigations. However, the final report of the ICAO was nothing beyond the Security Council's statement. They condemned the incident and offered some ethical recommendations.
Everybody interviewed in the combat center said that the plane was descending toward the Vincennes. But the electronic record shows it never descended toward the Vincennes. But everybody had that view. I mean, they totally deluded themselves as to the nature of the threat.
Later on, Iranians filed a formal complaint with the International Court of Justice at The Hague. The results of the Security Council meeting and the ICAO investigations had already shown that there would be no better ending to this case in The Hague as well.
Perhaps at the time of the ICAO release, we should have declassified the ship's position and issued a press release pointing out Vincennes' location within Iranian waters at the time of firing.
I spent an immense amount of time, probably the bulk of my time, looking at all the tracks and the various documentation that had been done on the tracks, and how uncertain that evidence is.
How do you explain, Admiral, the discrepancy that everything started in response to distress calls, and yet the Fogarty report later confirmed that it turned out that there were no distress calls?
I don't think I can explain, Congressman. I think he misspoke.
Mr. Fogarty?
Yes. I've talked to him about it. He doesn't remember it. I cannot reconcile it.
The reason why there was no final report is exclusively my fault. We didn't produce any further document, although we wanted to, and I got bogged down with something else that erupted. I forget what it was. The biggest problem you have in doing any investigation is the guy who commits the mistake, or whether it be an honest error or whether it be a grievous error, lies to his superiors to cover his own butt.
The commanding officer and crew members of the Vincennes cruiser received the U.S. Navy Medal of Honor once they completed their mission in the Persian Gulf. The passenger plane's case was closed after the agreement. However, history still remembers it, and every year people honor the memory of the travelers who never arrived at their destination.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
In the limelight.
While many rich nations continue to ease public health guidelines as they gradually move in the direction of normalcy, an ultra-contagious COVID-19 mutation known as the Delta variant is spreading like wildfire in certain countries, says Jake Johnson Ryder in an article published under the heading Ultra-contagious COVID Delta variant, wreaking havoc worldwide. Stay tuned for more. In Bangladesh, troops are preparing to patrol the streets to enforce newly imposed stay-at-home orders. Australia, recently heralded as a pandemic success story, is returning to strict lockdowns. Scotland is seeing a record-breaking surge in new coronavirus infections. Indonesia is teetering on the edge of a public health catastrophe. While many rich nations continue to ease public health guidelines as they gradually move in the direction of normalcy, an ultra-contagious COVID-19 mutation known as the Delta variant is spreading like wildfire in countries that have struggled to vaccinate their populations and in communities that have refused to participate in inoculation drives, forcing governments to resort to drastic measures to contain the damage. The new curbs on travel and daily life stretch from Australia and Bangladesh to South Africa and Germany, but authorities over the weekend set new limits on travelers from virus variant zones such as Portugal and Russia, the Washington Post reported recently. South Africa extended a nightly curfew and introduced a ban on gatherings, sales, indoor dinings, and some domestic travel for 14 days to halt a worrying surge in cases driven by the Delta variant. First detected in India, the Delta variant is rapidly emerging as the dominant coronavirus strain across the globe. The mutation, which is estimated to be 60% more transmissible than the highly contagious Alpha variant, has now been detected in more than 80 countries, and it accounts for over a third of all new cases in the United States. The Delta strain is the most contagious variant we've seen so far, said Dr. Ashish Juha, the dean of Brown University School of Public Health, adding, "It is wreaking havoc around the world and will cause problems here," referring to the United States. While the spread of Delta poses a particularly severe threat to Africa, South America, and other regions without adequate access to vaccines, the variant also puts at risk rich countries that continue to stand in the way of a patent waiver aimed at boosting the global vaccine supply. As the Financial Times reported recently, the rising number of cases have raised concerns that the Delta variant could halt the progress the EU has made over the past 2 months in driving down coronavirus infections and deaths. The leadership of the European Union, along with Canada and the UK, has been among the principal opponents of the proposed vaccine patent waiver, which would temporarily suspend global intellectual property rules that are barring manufacturers from producing generic vaccines. Experts estimate that around 11 billion doses are needed to vaccinate 70% of the global population. The EU's opposition to the TRIPS waiver is no longer a Europe-only topic, said John Whittle, senior policy advisor at Health Action International, adding, "It has become an issue of global concern as the need for a waiver to diversify and scale up production is more pressing than ever." Just over a month after classifying Delta as a variant of concern, World Health Organization officials stressed recently that the mutation has the potential to be more deadly than other strains because it's more efficient in the way it transmits between humans. Dr. Mike Ryan, executive director of the WHO's Health Emergencies Program, warned during a press conference that the variant will eventually find those vulnerable individuals who will become severely ill, have to be hospitalized, and potentially die. stem the spread of the Delta variant, the WHO recommended even fully vaccinated people should continue to wear masks and take other coronavirus-related precautions. Advice that conflicts with the U.S. Center for Disease Control's recent relaxation of mask guidelines for inoculated individuals. Vaccine alone won't stop community transmission, said Dr. Marian Galassimo, WHO's Assistant Director General for Access to Medicines and Health Products. People need to continue to use masks consistently, be in ventilated spaces, hand hygiene, the physical distance, avoid crowding. This still continues to be extremely important, even if you are vaccinated and you have a community transmission ongoing. Public health experts have long feared that leaving vast swathes of the world without access to vaccines risks allowing vaccine-resistant variants to emerge, a nightmare scenario that would mean a prolonged pandemic and more avoidable deaths. As Nature's Evan Calloway reported recently, Delta is moderately resistant to vaccines, particularly in people who have received just a single dose. The U.S. local governments are beginning to take action to prevent outbreaks amid growing concerns that Delta cases are on track to explode across the country. The Los Angeles County Department of Public Health advised that residents, including those who have been fully vaccinated, wear masks while indoor public spaces. Until we better understand how and to who the Delta variant is spreading, everyone should focus on maximum protection with minimum interruption to routine as all businesses operate without other restrictions like physical distancing and capacity limits, county officials said in a statement. Dr. Eric Fiegelding, a senior fellow at the Federation of American Scientists, warned recently that the U.S. is just several weeks away from experiencing a Delta surge similar to the U.K.'s, which was accompanied by a rise in hospitalizations and deaths. According to the latest data, less than half of the U.S. population is fully vaccinated, meaning large segments of the country are potentially vulnerable to the strain. As Common Dreams reported recently, Missouri communities that have either declined to get vaccinated or struggle to gain access to shots are quickly becoming U.S. hotspots for the Delta variant. We have seen this movie before elsewhere. The Delta variant creeps from the underbelly of falling cases of other variants, overtakes all variants, and then causes a surge, said Fiegelding, adding, don't let this happen where you are. This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.